This is Audible.
Welcome to the Audio Renaissance presentation of The Island of the Day Before, written by Umberto Eco. Translated from the Italian by William Weaver. Adapted for audio by Richard O'Connor. Produced by Tony Hutz. And read by Tim Curry.
I take pride withal in my humiliation. And as I am to this privilege condemned, almost I find joy in an abhorrent salvation. I am, I believe, alone of all our race, the only man in human memory to have been shipwrecked and cast up upon a deserted ship. Thus, with unabashed conceits, wrote Roberto della Griva, presumably in July or August of 1643. How many days had he been tossed by the waves? Feverish, surely, bound to a plank, his neck stiff, strained unnaturally so as not to imbibe the water, his lips burnt by the brine. His letters offer no answer to this question. Though they suggest an eternity, the time cannot have been more than 2 days, for otherwise he would never have survived. He, a sickly youth, as he describes himself, a creature condemned by a natural defect to live only at night. He was unable to keep track of time. But I believe the sea grew calm immediately after the tempest swept him from the deck of his ship, the Amaryllis, on that makeshift raft a sailor had fashioned for him. Driven by the trades over a serene sea, in a season when, south of the equator, a temperate winter reigns, he was carried for not many miles until the currents at last brought him into the bay. It was night. He had dozed off, unaware that he was approaching a ship until, with a jolt, his plank struck against the prow of the Daphne. And when, in the glow of the full moon, he realized he was floating beneath a bowsprit with a rope ladder hanging from it, in an instant all his spirit returned. I believe that at such moments, a dying man can become a very Hercules. Perhaps Roberto climbed up a bit at a time, exhausted at every gain, until he flung himself over the bulwarks, crawled to the forecastle. An instinct no doubt led him in the darkness to touch that barrel, pull himself up its side, until he found a cup attached to a little chain, and he drank as much as he could, then collapsed. He must have slept 24 hours. It was night when he woke, but he was as if reborn. So it was night again, not night still. He thought it was night still, for if not, a whole day had to have passed, and someone should have found him by now. The moonlight, coming from the deck, illuminated that place, apparently a kind of cookroom, where a pot was hanging above the fireplace. The room had 2 doors, one towards the bowsprit, the other opening onto the deck, and he looked out at the latter, seeing as if by daylight, the rigging in good order, the capstan, the masts with the sails furled, a few cannon at the gunports, and the outline of the quarter-deck. He made some sounds, but not a living soul replied. He gazed over the bulwarks, and to his right he could discern, about a mile away, the form of the island, the palm trees along its shore stirred by a breeze. Like any shipwrecked man, Roberto could not tell if it was an island or a continent. He staggered to the other side of the ship, and glimpsed, but distant this time, almost on the line of the horizon, the peaks of another mass, defined also by 2 promontories. Everything else was sea, giving the impression that the ship was berthed in an anchorage it had entered through a channel separating the 2 stretches of land. Roberto decided that if these were not 2 islands, one was surely an island facing a vaster body of land. A nice situation for a castaway, his feet solidly planted, and dry land within reach. But Roberto was unable to swim. Soon he would discover there was no longboat on board, and the current meanwhile had carried away the plank on which he had arrived. Hence his relief at having escaped death was now accompanied by dismay at this treble solitude of the sea, the neighboring island, and the ship. Roberto struggles back to the cookroom and finds a lamp there and a flint and steel, as if the cook set them in their place before going to bed. But the two berths beside the furnace are both empty. Roberto lights the lamp, looks around, and finds a great quantity of food. Dried fish, hardtack, with only a few patches of mold, easily scraped away with a knife. The fish is very salty, but there is water in abundance. He must have regained his strength quickly, or else he was strong when he was writing this to the lady of his heart. Son of my shadows, light of my darkness, why did heaven not unmake me in that tempest it had so savagely provoked? Why save from the all-devouring sea this body of mine, only to wreck my soul so horribly in such mean and even more ill-starred solitude? Perhaps if merciful heaven does not send me succor, you will never read this letter, and I will become dark to your eyes. Bereft of your gaze, I am blind, for you see me not. Dumb, for you address me not. Oblivious, for you forget me. My lady, I write you as if to offer unworthy tribute, the withered rose of my disheartenment. And yet I take pride withal in my humiliation, and as I am to this privilege condemned, almost I find joy in an abhorrent salvation. I am, I believe, alone of all our race, the only man in human memory to have been shipwrecked and cast upon a deserted ship. But is this really possible? To judge by the date of his first letter, Roberto begins writing immediately after his arrival, as soon as he finds pen and paper in the captain's quarters, before exploring the rest of the ship. And yet he must have required some time to recover his strength, reduced as he was to the condition of a wounded animal. It is difficult to reconstruct the actions and feelings of a character surely afire with true love. But then, what do we know of the difference between passion felt and passion expressed? And who can say which has precedence? So Roberto was writing for himself. This was not literature. He was there, truly, writing like an adolescent pursuing an impossible mirage, streaking the page with his tears. Not because of the absence of the lady, but out of fondness of himself, enamored of love. The situation is the stuff of a novel, but once more, where to begin? I say he wrote this first missive later, and before writing it, he had a look around. And in subsequent letters he will relate what he saw, but those, too, raise the question of how to treat the diary of a man with poor vision, who roams during the night, relying on his weak eyes. Roberto will tell us that his eyes had been affected since the days of the siege of Casale, when that bullet grazed his temple, and this may be true. Roberto was certainly frail, and I infer he was also a hypochondriac, though in moderation, afflicted by photophobia. Sick or not, he hates the sun, spends the first night in the cookroom. Day frightens him. Not only will his eyes not tolerate it, but neither will the burns he must surely have on his back. So he goes to ground. He is convinced that this will be his life for a long time, perhaps until his death. So he refashions his lady on paper so as not to lose her. At this point he takes refuge in his nightly vigils as in a maternal womb, and becomes thus more determined to elude the sun. On the second night, after finding a store of food in the cookroom, Roberto somehow proceeded in the moonlight to cross the deck. He concluded that the Daphne was a Dutch fluke or flyboat, those trading vessels of medium displacement, usually armed with about 10 cannons. Given its dimensions, it could be handled by a dozen seamen, and could carry many more passengers if it renounced comforts, scarce to begin with, cramming the space with pallets. In the center of the deck there should have been a longboat big enough to contain the entire crew. The fact that it was not there suggested the crew was elsewhere, but this did not reassure Roberto. An entire crew never leaves the ship unmanned, at the mercy of the sea, even if that ship is at anchor, its sails struck, in a calm bay. That evening he promptly headed for the aft quarters. Set next to the tiller, the compass told him that the channel between the two stretches of land ran from south to north. Then he found himself in the wardroom, an L-shaped cabin from which another door admitted him to the captain's quarters, with its large porthole over the rudder and accesses to the gallery. To the left of the wardroom, there were two little cubbyholes for junior officers. On the right, another cabin had been created, almost wider than the captain's, with a plain bunk at the end, but otherwise arranged as a workspace. The table was cluttered with maps, more numerous, it seemed to Roberto, than those a ship normally requires for navigation. This room seemed a scholar's study. Among the papers he saw some spyglasses, more papers covered with calculations, and a parchment with circular drawings in red and black, which he recognized. He had seen various copies of the same on the Amaryllis, as a reproduction of the Ephemerides of Regiomontanus, an astrological almanac. He went back into the wardroom. Stepping out into the gallery, he could see the island. He could stare, Roberto wrote, with lynx eyes at its silence. In other words, the island was there, as it had been before. In a chest, he found a handsome suit of clothing of the captain's. Pulling on the boots must have made him feel in his element once again. Roberto examined the tabletop until he found, lying open, apparently left interrupted, beside the goose quill pen and the inkwell, the ship's log. The first page told him the name of the ship, but the rest of it was incomprehensible, and it was of little help for him to learn that the captain was Flemish. Still, the last line bore a date, now a few weeks past, and after a few meaningless words, an expression in proper Latin stood out denoting the bubonic plague. It was a hint of explanation. An epidemic had broken out on board. This news did not trouble Roberto. He had had his bout of plague 13 years earlier, and that serpent does not dare introduce itself a second time into the loins of one who has previously tamed it. So they were all dead. But in that case, he should have found, scattered in disorder on the deck, the corpses of the last, since the first to die must have been given Christian burial at sea. Moving on, he found a musket, a sword, and a knife. He had been a soldier. He picked up the musket, and he also slipped the knife into his belt. He had decided to explore the hull from prow to poop. Back in the cookroom, by a little ladder set against the bowsprit, he descended into the larder where provisions for a long voyage had been stored. The crew, since they could not store enough for the duration of the journey, had only recently replenished supplies at some friendly shore. There were baskets of fish, just smoked, and pyramids of coconuts, and barrels of tubers of an unfamiliar shape, but apparently edible. And there were fruits such as Roberto had seen on the Amaryllis after its first tropical ports of call, fruits that resisted the seasons. And some island crop must have produced those sacks of grey flour that smelled of limestone, and also of the loaves whose taste recalled what the Indians of the New World called potatoes. In the corner he saw also about a dozen little kegs with bungholes. He tapped the first, and tasted water, only recently collected, and treated with sulphur to make it last longer. There was not a great deal, but considering that the fruit too would slake his thirst, he could survive on the ship for a long time. But now, he heard coming nearer, not a squeaking, but a chirping and a scratching of paws. Roberto wondered if, musket in hand, he should confront immediately that Armageddon. His heart beat irregularly. He called himself a coward, knowing that sooner or later he would have to face them. Instead, he climbed to the deck and ran to the cabin that was now his, barred the door, placed his weapons within reach, and prepared to sleep. Restless, he dreamed of his shipwreck. But that dream made Roberto's sleep so uneasy that it was limited to a very brief time. So he mustered his courage, collected his weapons, and with audacious fear set out to find the source of those nocturnal noises. Moving about, he was struck by a distant concert. Sounds coming surely from the island. He realized that for the first time in his life, he was hearing birds really sing. And he had never heard so many, so various. By the thousands they hailed the sunrise. It seemed to him that he could recognize, among the parrot's cries, the nightingale, the blackbird, an infinite number of swallows, and even the shrill sound of the cicada and the cricket. The island was distant, and yet he had the impression that those sounds carried a scent of orange blossoms and basil, as if the air of all the bay was steeped in perfume. He sniffed and listened to that invisible throng, as if looking from the battlements of a castle or the slit windows of a fort, at an army vociferously fanning out along the slope of the hill and the plain below and along the river that protected the walls. He had the impression of having already experienced what he was imagining, and in the face of the immensity that besieged him, he felt besieged. He was at Casale again, and before him was spread out the Spanish army, with the noise of its wagons, the clash of arms, the tenor voices of the Castilians, the shouting of the Neapolitans, the harsh grunts of mercenaries. As if his life had been spent between two sieges, Roberto lived again the days of Casale. Roberto tells us very little about the 16 years of his life preceding that summer of 1630. He refers to episodes of the past only when they seem to have some connection with his present on the Daphne, and the chronicler of his turbulent annals must read between the lines of the story. The Pozzo di San Patrizio family belonged to the minor nobility, lords of the vast estate of La Griva, along the border of the province of Alessandria, a part of the Duchy of Milan, and hence Spanish territory. But they considered themselves vassals of the Marquis of Monferrato. Roberto's father spoke French with his wife, the local dialect with his peasants, and Italian with foreigners. To his son, he expressed himself in various ways, depending on whether he was teaching the boy a secret of swordsmanship or taking him on a ride through the fields, cursing the birds that were ruining the crops. For the rest, the young Roberto spent his time without friends, daydreaming of distant lands as he wandered bored through the vineyards, or of falconry if he was hunting swallows, or combating dragons as he played with his dogs, or hidden treasure as he explored the rooms of their little castle or fort, as it could also be called. His mind was inspired to wander thus by the dusty volumes of romances and chivalric poems he found in the South Tower. Roberto even had a tutor, a Carmelite, who once a year would arrive at the castle with a manservant and four little mules laden with books and other scribblings, and he would be housed there for 3 months. What he taught his pupil I cannot say, but when Roberto turned up in Paris, he made a favorable impression. In any case, he was quick to learn whatever he was told. Of this Carmelite, only one thing is known, and it is no accident that Roberto mentions it. One day, old Pozzo cut himself while polishing a sword, and the wound provoked severe pain. Then the Carmelite took the blade and sprinkled on it some powder that he kept in a little box. Immediately, old Pozzo swore he felt relief. In fact, the next day the wound was already healing. The Carmelite enjoyed the general amazement, and he told father and son how the secret of this substance had been revealed to him by an Arab. When they asked him why the powder was put not on the wound, but rather on the blade that had produced it, he answered that such is the working of nature, among whose strongest forces is a universal sympathy, which governs actions at a distance. He added that if this seemed hard to believe, they had only to think of the magnet, which is a stone that draws metal filings to itself, or of the great iron mountains which cover the northern part of our planet and attract the needle of the compass. And so the unguent, adhering firmly to the sword, drew out those virtues of iron that the sword had left in the wound, impeding its healing. Any man who in youth witnesses something of this sort cannot but remain marked by it for the rest of his life. And we shall soon see how Roberto's destiny was sealed by his attraction towards the attractive power of powders and unguents. This, however, was not what left the greatest mark on Roberto's boyhood. It seems that his father, in the first 5 years of Roberto's life, would lift him from the ground and shout proudly, "You are my firstborn!" Nothing strange, to be sure, beyond the redundance, since Roberto was an only child. But as he grew up, Roberto began to remember, or convinced himself that he remembered, how, at these outbursts of paternal joy, his mother's face would assume an expression of pleasure mingled with uneasiness. Roberto's imagination concluded that his father did not utter it as if it were an assertion of the obvious, but rather as an odd investiture, underlining the you, as if to say, you, and not another, are my firstborn son. In Roberto's letters there appears always some reference to an other, who haunts him. The idea seems to have been born in him during those very years when he became convinced that somewhere an unrecognized brother was at large, who must have been of an evil nature, as their father had repudiated him. A brother in some way guilty of the rejection he had suffered, and because of it he surely hated him, Roberto, the favorite. The shadow of this enemy brother had troubled his nights as a boy. Later, in adolescence, he leafed through old volumes in the library, hoping to find hidden there, what? A portrait? A certificate from the curate? A revelatory confession? Gradually he had also come to give this lost brother a name, Ferrante, and had begun attributing to him the little crimes of which he himself was wrongfully accused, like the theft of a cake or the improper liberation of a dog from his chain. Ferrante, privileged by his banishment, acted behind Roberto's back, and Roberto, in turn, hid behind Ferrante. Indeed, little by little, the habit of blaming the non-existent brother for what he, Roberto, could not have done, became transformed into the habit of inculpating him with what Roberto had done, and of which he repented. It was not that Roberto told others a lie. Rather, silently assuming the punishment for his own misdeeds, he managed to convince himself of his innocence, and to feel the victim of an injustice. But I digress. We have still to establish how Roberto arrived at the siege of Casale. And here we must give fantasy free rein, and imagine how it might have happened. In December of 1627, the Duke Vincenzo II of Mantua is dying, and around the deathbed of the Duke with no heir, there is a ballet of four claimants, with their agents and their protectors. The victor is the Marquis of Saint-Charmont, who manages to convince Vincenzo that the inheritance should go to a cousin in the French line, Charles de Gonzaga, Duke of Nevers. Old Vincenzo, between one dying gasp and the next, allows Nevers to marry in great haste his niece Maria Gonzaga. Then he dies, leaving his new nephew the dukedom. Now Nevers was French, and the duchy he was inheriting included Monferrato with Casale, its capital, the most important fortress in northern Italy. Situated as it was between Spanish Milan and the lands of the Savoys, Monferrato controlled the upper Po River, the passes between the Alps and the south, the road from Milan to Genoa, and it acted as a cushion between France and Spain. Neither of the two powers could trust that other cushion state, the Duchy of Savoy, where Charles Emmanuel I was playing a game that it would have been kind to call duplicitous. If Monferrato went to Nevers, practically speaking, it would go to Richelieu. So Spain obviously preferred someone else inherit. The other pretenders could only hope that the Germanic Holy Roman Emperor would refuse to ratify the succession. But the Spanish were impatient, and while all were waiting for the Emperor to come to a decision, Casale had already been besieged once by Gonzalo de Cordoba. Now, for the second time, an imposing army of Spaniards and Imperials, commanded by Spinola, was surrounding it. The French garrison was preparing to resist, expecting a French army to come to its aid, but that army was still engaged in the north, and only God knew if it would arrive at Casale in time. This was more or less the situation when old Pozzo assembled before the castle the younger men of his household and the most keen of his peasants, and distributed the arms in his possession. Then he called Roberto, and to all made this speech.
Now listen to me, the lot of you. This land of ours, La Griva, has always paid tribute to the Lord of Monferrato, the Duke of Mantua. Now the Duke is this Nevers, and if anybody comes and tells me that Nevers is not a Mantuan or a Monferino, I'll kick his backside, because you're nothing but a bunch of ignoramuses, incapable of understanding these things, so best keep your mouth shut and leave everything to your master, who at least knows what honor is. For most of you I know, honor is not worth spitting on, but let me tell you something. If the Imperials enter Casale, they are not men with scruples. Your vineyards will go to hell, and as for your women, better not think about it. So we are off to defend Casale. I am not forcing anybody, but if there is some lazy, lily-livered lout who does not agree with me, he should speak up right now, and I will have him hanged from that oak.
Roberto began to see war as a splendid experience, and thus it was that one fine day, from the top of a hill, they saw the city below their feet and before their eyes. It was guarded to the north, at their left, by the broad stripe of the Po, which just in front of the fortress was divided by two great islands in the midst of the river, which curved sharply towards the south at the great star-shaped bulk of the citadel. Casale seemed impregnable on the outside, all bristling as it was with saw-toothed bastions and towers. It was a grand sight, but not to Pozzo, who said,
"Men, this time we're truly buggered."
And to Roberto, who asked why, he added with a slap on the nape,
"Don't play stupid. Those soldiers in the field are Imperials. The Casale men and the French are inside, piling up bales of straw and fouling their pants, because there aren't even 2,000 of them, whereas those men down there must number at least 100,000.
He was exaggerating. Spinola's army counted only 18,000 foot and 6,000 cavalry, but that was enough, more than enough. Someone must have reported their arrival to the commander of the garrison, Monsieur de Toirat, a one-time comrade in arms of old Pozzo. Hearty embraces preceded a first stroll along the ramparts.
"My dear friend," Toirat was saying,
"according to the rolls in Paris, I am commanding a total of 10,000 foot soldiers, but Monsieur de la Grange has only 500 men. Monchard has 250. In all, I can count on 1,700 men on foot. Then I have 6 companies of light cavalry, a total of only 400 men. The Cardinal knows I have fewer men than I should. I have had to recruit a regiment of Italians as best I could, Corsicans and Monferrato men, but, forgive me for saying so, they are poor soldiers. Your men will join the Italian regiment, under Captain Bassiani, a good man." Jean de Saint-Bonnet, Lord of Trois-Rats, was tall, dark, with blue eyes, in the full maturity of his 45 years. He was choleric but generous, and naturally conciliatory, brusque in manner but generally affable, also with his soldiers. He had distinguished himself in the war against the English, but apparently he was not liked by Cardinal Richelieu and the court.
"This is the situation, my friend," Toirat was saying. "Among our adversaries, we have even a Florentine regiment commanded by a Medici. We count on Casale as a city. The castle, from which we control the side towards the river, is a fine fort, defended by a good moat, and at the walls we have made a fine gun platform that will allow the defenders to work well. The citadel has 60 cannon and solidly built bastions. There are some weak points, but I have reinforced them. All this is excellent for withstanding a frontal assault, but Spinola is no novice. Look at those men at work down there. They are preparing tunnels for mines, and when they arrive here below at the wall, it will be as if we had opened the gates to them. To stop their work, we would have to confront them in the open field, but there we are weaker. And as soon as the enemy has brought those cannons closer, he will start bombarding the city. And here the mood of the Casale civilians becomes important, and I don't trust them very far. For that matter, I can understand them. The safety of their city means more to them than does Monsieur de Nevers, and they are not yet convinced that dying for France is a good thing. They must be made to understand that with Savoy or with the Spanish they would lose their freedom, and Casale would no longer be a capital, but simply another ordinary fortress. In any case, we will improvise. After all, this is an Italian comedy. You see those hovels in the plain? If they were ours, we would have many enemy positions within range. A spy tells me they are empty, and this report gives me good reason to fear that men are hiding there. Tomorrow, our infantry will go and occupy those houses. Rather than keep the troops inside the walls to rot, better to expose them to fire, which is good training. You see those walls over there? They are part of a little outwork the local men began before the enemy arrived. I believe it is best to occupy it before the Imperials do. We must keep them within range on the plain in order to harass them and impede the construction of the tunnels. In short, there will be glory for all. Now, let us go to supper. The siege has only begun, and provisions are still plentiful. It will be a while before we start eating the rats.
He had not been reduced to eating rats, only to arrive on the Daphne, where perhaps the rats would eat him. Timorously meditating on this nice contrast, Roberto was finally prepared to explore those places from which, the evening before, he had heard noises. Descending from the quarterdeck, he found a room organized with great economy, hammocks for a dozen men. The pallets were all in perfect order. He mustered his courage as he opened the door leading to the feared place. Overhead were vast gratings that perforated the main deck. Thanks to them, this lower deck had been transformed into a kind of nave, illuminated through the hatches by the full daylight that fell obliquely, intersecting the light that came from the gun ports. At first, Roberto perceived only shafts of sunlight, in which infinite corpuscles could be observed swirling. As he saw them, he could not help but recall the words with which the canon of Digne invited him to observe the cascades of light that spread through the darkness of a cathedral, stirring a multitude of atoms engaged in combat. Obvious proof of the composition of this universe of ours, made of nothing but prime bodies teeming in the void. Immediately thereafter, he had the impression of being in a garden, and he realized that from the moment he entered this place, he had been assailed by a host of odors, far stronger than those that had come to him earlier from the shore. A garden, an indoor orchard, is what the men from the Daphne had created in this space, to carry home flowers and plants from the islands they were exploring. The gratings allowed the sun, the winds, and the rains to keep the vegetation alive. Flowers, shrubs, saplings have been brought here with their roots and earth and set in baskets and makeshift cases. But many of the containers had rotted. The earth had spilled out to create from one container to the next a layer of damp humus where the shoots of some plants were already taking root. It was like being in an Eden sprouting from the very planks of the Daphne. None of those flowers or those fruits was known to him. Each seemed generated by the fancy of a painter. Overwhelmed by the spell of the place, Roberto did not reflect on the residue of rain that the leaves were holding, though it had surely not rained for at least 3 days. The perfumes that stunned him led him to consider any enchantment natural. Moving farther into the lower deck, still hearing the distant birds of the island, and convinced he was hearing them through the openings of the hull, Roberto now realized those sounds were much closer, towards the prow, in the direction of that storeroom from which he had heard noises the night before. He was passing the trunk of the mainmast, heading for the prow, when he saw the aviary. He could think of no other definition for that collection of wicker cages with solid boughs run through them to serve as perches, inhabited by flying creatures striving to discern that dawn of which they had only a beggared light, and to reply with distorted voices to the call of their similars, singing in freedom on the island. Set on the ground, or hanging from the hatch of the deck above, the cages were arranged along this other nave like stalagmites and stalactites, creating another grotto of wonders, where the fluttering animals made their dwellings rock beneath the sun's rays, in a glitter of hues, a flurry of rainbows. He could give no names to these creatures, except the names of birds of his own hemisphere. That one is a heron, he said to himself, that a crane, a quail, but it was like calling a goose a swan. Here prelates with broad cardinal trains spread grass-colored wings, swelling a rosy throat and revealing an azure breast, chanting an almost human sound. There multiple squads assaulted the domes that circumscribed their arena among dove-gray flashes and red and yellow thrusts. Grouchy light cavalry, with long nervous legs in a cramped space, shaking the tufts on their elongated heads. In one cage, built to his measure, a great captain in a bluish cloak, his jerkin as vermilion as his eye, and a cornflower plume on his helmet, emitted a dove's lament. Roberto was divided between excitement at his discovery, pity for the prisoners, and the desire to release them and see his cathedral invaded by those heralds of an airy army. He imagined they were hungry, and saw that in the cages there were only crumbs of food, and the dishes and bowls that should have contained water were empty. But not far off he found sacks of grain and shreds of dried fish, prepared by those who meant to take this booty to Europe, for a ship does not go into the seas of the opposite south without bringing back to the courts or academies evidence of those worlds. Proceeding further, he found also a pen made of planks with a dozen animals scratching inside it, belonging, he decided, to the poultry species, even though at home he had never seen any with such plumage. They, too, seemed hungry, but the hens had laid 6 eggs. Roberto seized 1 egg immediately, pierced it with the tip of his knife, and sucked it, as he had done as a child. Then he placed the others inside his shirt, and, to compensate the mothers and fathers, he distributed water and food, and he then did the same, cage by cage. He reconsidered his thought of freeing the birds, and decided that if his exile were to last long, they might even prove edible. The hidalgos before Casale, the lesser nobles, were beautiful and vari-colored too, and yet we fired on them, and if the siege had lasted, he would even have eaten them. Casale he had entered of his own choice, to prevent others from entering. He had been cast up on the Daphne, and yearned only to leave it. Casale, at the beginning, was a story of sorties. The morning after the men from La Griva arrived, Thoirat sent some single officers to observe what the Neapolitans were installing on the hill conquered the previous day. The officers approached too closely, shots were exchanged, and a young lieutenant was killed. His comrades carried him back inside the walls, and Roberto saw the first slain man in his life. Thoirat decided to have his men occupy the hovels he had mentioned the day before. From the bastions, it was easy to observe the advance of the 10 musketeers, who at a certain point separated in an attempt to seize the first house. Cannon fire from the walls passed above their heads and tore the roof off the house. Spaniards dashed out and fled. The musketeers let them escape, took the house, barricaded themselves inside, and began laying down a harassing fire towards the hill. It seemed advisable to repeat the operation against the other houses, since it was clear that the Neapolitans had begun digging trenches. But these did not circumscribe the hill, they ran towards the plain. Roberto learned that this was how the enemy started constructing mine tunnels. Once these reached the walls, they would be packed with kegs of powder. It was thus necessary to prevent the initial digging from reaching a depth sufficient to allow further digging underground, otherwise the enemy from that point on could work undercover. This was the whole game. To anticipate the construction of the tunnels, and to dig counter-mine tunnels of one's own from the other direction, until the relief army arrived. In a siege, there is nothing else to do. Harry the other side, and wait. The following morning, it was time to man the outwork. Roberto found himself grasping his musket in the midst of an unruly bunch of men. With some surly Corsicans, they were all crammed into boats to cross the Po, after 2 French companies had already touched the other shore. Thoirat and his staff observed, and old Pozzo saluted his son before waving him on. The 3 companies made camp in the outwork. Construction had not been completed, and part of the finished walls had already collapsed. The men spent the day barricading the gaps. The position was well protected by a ditch, beyond which some sentries were posted. When night fell, the sky was so bright that not even the officers considered an attack possible. But suddenly they heard the charge sounded, and they saw the Spanish light cavalry appear. Roberto had been set by Captain Bassiani behind some bales of straw that patched a fallen part of the outer wall. He had no time to realize what was happening. Each cavalryman had a musketeer behind him, and as they arrived at the ditch, the horses began to follow it, surrounding the post while the musketeers fired, eliminating the few sentries. Then each musketeer jumped from his horse's back, rolling into the ditch. As the horsemen formed a semicircle before the entrance, opening heavy fire and forcing the defenders to seek cover, the musketeers, unharmed, reached the gate and the more vulnerable breaches. The Italian company, which was on guard, had emptied its weapons and then scattered, seized with panic. But the French companies could do no better. Between the first attack and the scaling of the walls, only a few minutes had passed, and the rest of the men were surprised by the attackers, who were inside the walls before the defenders could even grab their weapons. The enemy, exploiting this surprise, was slaughtering the garrison. Roberto, after firing on the musketeers, was unprepared for the charge of the cavalry. As the charge passed over his head through the breach, a horse's hooves buried him under the collapsing barricade. It was a stroke of luck. Protected by the fallen bales, he survived the first murderous impact. Captain Bassiani, to compensate for the shame of his men's rout, fought on bravely, but he was surrounded and had to surrender. Thoirat, having been wakened abruptly, now arrived at full tilt. It quickly became clear that the French were routed, and the only thing to do was to lay down some covering fire to help the survivors reach the river. Old Pozzo, a man who knew the whims of the river, chose a spot opposite one of the sandbars and spurred his horse into the water. Crossing a bar, he was on the other shore without even having made the animal swim, and he dashed like a madman, sword upraised, towards the outwork. As the sky was already growing light, a group of enemy musketeers surrounded him, having no idea who this solitary rider was. The solitary rider rode through them, eliminating at least five with unerring downward blows. He encountered two cavalrymen, made his horse rear, bent to one side, avoiding a thrust, and suddenly sat erect, swinging his blade in a circle. The first adversary slumped over his saddle with his guts slipping down into his boots as the horse ran off. The second remained with his eyes wide, his fingers seeking one ear which, while still attached to his cheek, was hanging below his chin. Emerging from the straw, Roberto saw him at a distance, and, before recognizing his father, he recognized Pagnufli, his father's mount, and his own playmate for years. He stuck two fingers into his mouth and let out a whistle the animal knew well. Pagnufli reared, pricked up his ears, and began carrying the father towards the breach. Pozzo saw Roberto and shouted, "What are you doing in a place like that? Mount, you lunatic!" And as Roberto sprang onto the horse's back and clung to his father's waist, Pozzo said, "God's truth, you're never where you should be." Then, spurring Pagnufli again, he galloped off toward the river. In a great cloud of dust, they crossed the ground and, amid violent spray, the river, while in the distance some men were still emptying their weapons after them. They reached the right bank to applause. Thoirat said to Roberto, "La Grive, today all of them ran off and only you remained. You're wasted in that company of cowards. You will join my staff." Roberto thanked him, and then, climbing down from the saddle, held out a hand to his father, who clasped it. Now Roberto no longer deloused himself in the soldiers' quarters, but sat at Thoirat's table amid gentlemen from Paris, and he listened to their boasts, their recollections of other campaigns, their fatuous or brilliant talk. In these conversations, beginning on the very first evening, he was given reason to believe that the siege of Casale was not the enterprise he had thought he was to take part in. He had come here to bring to life his dreams of chivalry, nourished by the poems he had read at La Griva. To come from good stock, and to have finally a sword at his side, meant becoming a paladin, who might cast away his life for a word from his king, or for the rescue of a lady. After his arrival, the devout host he had joined proved to be a mob of slothful peasants ready to turn and run at the first sign of a fight. Now he was admitted to an assembly of heroes who welcomed him as one of their own. He knew that his heroism was the result of a misunderstanding. He had stayed in the outwork, all right, but only because he was even more frightened than those who had fled it. And worse, after Monsieur de Thoirat retired, and the others stayed up all night gossiping freely, Roberto came to realize that the whole siege was nothing but one more chapter in a meaningless history. True, Don Vincenzo of Mantua had died and left the dukedom to Nevers, but if someone else had been present at the old man's deathbed, the story could have turned out quite differently. Seeing how things stood, Charles Emmanuel decided that Louis XIII was a most welcome guest, received him, asking him only not to waste time at Casale, but to help him take Genoa instead. He was courteously invited not to talk nonsense, and was given a handsome goose quill to sign a treaty allowing the French freedom of action in Piedmont. Charles Emmanuel was authorized to exact an annual rent from the Duke of Mantua for Monferrato. One of Roberto's table companions recalled, "And so Nevers, to keep what was his, agreed to pay rent to someone who had never been its owner." "And he paid," another man laughed.
"Nevers has always had to pay for his follies," said an abbé, who had been introduced to Roberto as Toiras' confessor. "Nevers is a jester of God. He has always been dominated solely by the idea of assembling the Christian princes for a new crusade."
The officers seated around the table told the whole story as if it was all entirely natural. Indeed, some agreed and remarked, "For reasons of state." Meanwhile, the emperor remembered that by treaty, Mantua was in the hands of a commissioner, and Nevers could neither pay nor not pay for something that was still not his due. The emperor lost patience and sent 20,000 men to besiege the city. The Pope, seeing Protestant mercenaries running about Italy, imagined another sack of Rome and sent troops to the Mantuan border. Spinola decided to besiege Casale again, but seriously this time. In December of 1629, the French again crossed the Alps. According to their pact, Charles Emmanuel should have let them pass, but evidence of his reliability, he reiterated his claims to the Monferrato and demanded 6,000 French soldiers to besiege Genoa, which was really an obsession of his. Richelieu, who considered him a snake, said neither yes nor no. Roberto was expecting an account of a great attack, but no, the king did not attack. He made a surprise diversion to another town and appropriated it. The French army was still engaged in the north, and no one could say if it would arrive in time before Casale fell. They could only hope in God, the abbé said. Gentlemen, it is political wisdom to realize that human means must always be sought as if divine means did not exist, and divine means sought as if human means did not exist.
So let us hope in divine means, one gentleman exclaimed,
but with an expression anything but devout, waving his cup until he had spilled some wine on the abbé's cassock.
"Sir, you have stained me with wine," the abbé cried, blanching, which was the form indignation took in those days.
The other replied,
"Pretend that the mishap occurred during mass at consecration. Wine is wine." "Monsieur de Saint-Savin," the abbé cried, rising and putting his hand to his sword, "this is not the first time you have dishonored your own name by taking our lords in vain. You would have done better, God forgive me, to stay in Paris dishonoring the ladies."
"Come, come," Saint-Savin replied, obviously drunk. "We went about at night to provide music for the ladies, but when the lady failed to come to her window, we knew she preferred to remain in the bed the family confessor was warming for her."
The other officers had risen and were restraining the abbé, who tried to draw his sword. "Monsieur de Saint-Savin is in his cups," they said to him. Allowances had to be made for a man who had fought well those recent days out of respect for the comrades who had just died. The abbé went out, and Saint-Savin abruptly drained his cup, admonished Roberto with a raised finger, as if to direct him to a proper life and to the supreme mysteries of our holy religion.
"Sir, be proud. Today you came close to a happy death. Behave in the future with the same nonchalance, knowing that the soul dies with the body. Go then to death after having savored life. But since, unlike animals, we know we must die, let us prepare for that moment by enjoying the life that has been given us by chance and for chance. Let wisdom teach us to employ our days in drinking and amiable conversation, as is proper to gentlemen scorning base spirits. Lord God, war is a beautiful thing, but I want to fight for my own pleasure, and not because my adversary eats meat on Friday. The pagans were wiser than we. They had their three gods, but at least they did not claim to give birth and yet remain a virgin."
"Sir,"
Roberto protested, as the others laughed.
Sir,
Saint-Savin replied, the first quality of an honest man is contempt for religion, which would have us afraid of the most natural thing in the world, which is death, and would have us hate the one beautiful thing destiny has given us, which is life.
That will do, Monsieur de Saint-Savin.
An officer virtually ordered him, taking him by the arm. Do not scandalize this young friend of ours, as yet unaware that in Paris nowadays blasphemy is the most exquisite of forms. He might take you too seriously. And you, Monsieur de la Grive, go to bed too. Remember that the good Lord, in his mercy, will forgive even Monsieur de Saint-Savin. He went out, accompanied by the officer, who said to Roberto, keep him as your friend, and don't vex him any more than necessary. He has felled more Frenchmen in Paris over a point of theology than my whole company has run through Spaniards in these days. I would not want him next to me at mass, but I would consider myself fortunate to have him beside me on the field. Roberto worked the next morning above the Daphne at cockcrow, but he dawdled at length. When in the gallery he opened the window a crack, he realized he had risen later than the day before, and dawn was already becoming sunrise. He had, in fact, heard the hens announcing a new provision of eggs, and he had the thought of treating himself that evening to a pullet roasted on a spit. But he took the time to trim with the captain's scissors his moustache, beard, and hair, all still a castaways. He had decided to enjoy his shipwreck like a holiday in a country villa, which offered him an extended suite of dawns, daybreaks, and sunsets. So less than an hour after the hens cackling, he went below and immediately realized that while they must have laid their eggs, for the cackling could not have been a lie, there was not an egg to be seen. And further, all the birds had fresh feed, neatly distributed, still untouched. Curious as it may seem, his first feeling was of jealousy. Someone else was master of his ship, and stole from him those cares and those perquisites to which he was entitled. Losing the world to gain an abandoned vessel, only to find that someone else inhabited it, seemed to him as unbearable as the fear that his lady might become prey to the desire of another. Then a more rational concern ensued. Just as the world of his childhood had been inhabited by an other who preceded him and followed him, clearly the Daphne had holds and quarters he did not yet know, where a hidden guest lived, who followed his steps the moment he had gone, or took them a moment before he did. He ran to hide, too, in his berth, like the African ostrich that, hiding his head, thinks to erase the world. To reach the quarter-deck, he passed the head of a ladder that descended to the hold. What could be hidden down there, considering that on the lower deck he had found a miniature island? Was that the realm of the intruder? You see, he was already acting towards the ship as towards an object of love, which makes all who had previously possessed it seem usurpers. And it is at this point that Roberto confesses, writing to the lady, that when he saw her for the first time, and he saw her because his eyes followed another man's gaze addressed to her, he felt the revulsion of one who espies a caterpillar on a rose. By now Roberto was becoming lost in a shifting maze, where every junction led him back always to a single image. He suffered doubly, because of the island he did not have, and because of the ship that had him. Both unattainable, and both stood for a beloved who eluded him, blandishing him with promises that he made to himself alone. But tormenting himself as he does, Roberto promptly connects the anguish he is feeling to the other anguish he felt at Casale, this with effects, as we shall see, far more dire. While little skirmishes followed one another, Thuarat concluded that a more substantial sortie had to be attempted. Clearly the game was being played between spies and counter-spies. At Casale, rumor had it that the relief army was near, led by the king himself. Roberto was amazed when Thuarat instructed some Corsicans to desert and go over to Spinola, reporting that the army was not expected until September. But then he heard the commander explain to his staff, "If Spinola believes he has time, he will take time to dig his tunnels, and we will have time to dig our own tunnels against his mines. And since he cannot execute a frontal attack, he will have to spend a fortune in purchasing betrayal. So we will send spies to Spinola." Old Pozzo explained how in certain areas the terrain was notoriously treacherous, infiltrated by the waters of the river, and there Spinola could dig as long as he pleased, and his sappers would choke to death on snails. Whereas in other areas, digging tunnels was child's play, and there they should hammer with the artillery and make sorties.
"Very well," said Toirat. "Tomorrow we will force them to move and defend their positions."
The next morning the troops were in readiness on the covered way above the counterscarp and inside the walls. At a signal from Toirat, who was overlooking everything from the citadel, the first contingent, fairly numerous, moved in the deceitful direction. It was a fine parade, and later everyone realized that this was precisely how the Spaniards had seen it. Roberto saw 35 men who, obeying Captain Colomba, scattered and attacked a ditch. Toirat ordered his cannon to fire at the trench from the walls, while Colomba assailed the ditch from both flanks. The Spaniards reluctantly resumed their position and were overrun. There was no immediate counterattack, and Toirat made the mistake of considering that an error of the enemy, whereas it was calculated. Believing that the Imperials were bent on sending more troops to contain that assault, Toirat goaded them with more cannonades, but the men merely fired into the city, and one ball damaged the church of Sant' Antonio, quite near staff headquarters.
"Forgive me, dear friend," Pozzo said, addressing Toirat, "but I've had a bellyful of those lousy Spaniards, and if you don't mind, I'll knock off two or three just to show we can dance the galliard when we have to."
Uttering a vile oath against his adversaries, Pozzo then rode outside the gate and galloped like a fury, his sword raised against the enemy host. He obviously didn't mean to put them to flight, but it seemed proper to him to act on his own just to show the others. As proof of his courage, it was good. As a military action, very bad. A ball struck his forehead, and he slumped onto the withers of his pañufli. A second volley rose against the rampart, and Roberto felt a violent blow to the temple, like a stone. He staggered. He had been grazed, but he freed himself from the arms of the man supporting him. Shouting his father's name, he stood erect and glimpsed Pañufli, bewildered, galloping with his master's lifeless body across the empty field. Once again, Roberto thrust his fingers into his mouth and emitted his whistle. Pañufli heard and came back towards the walls, but slowly, at a solemn little trot, so as not to unsaddle his rider, no longer imperiously pressing his flanks. The horse came in again, neighing for his dead master, returning the body to Roberto, who closed those still wide eyes and wiped clean that face spattered with blood now clotted, while his own blood, alive, striped his cheek. That shot may have touched a nerve. The next day, after the requiem for his father, Roberto could hardly tolerate the light of day. From then on, his eyes continued to ache. Today, students of the psyche would say that because his father had entered the shadows, Roberto also wanted to enter the shadows. He knew little of the psyche, but to give some sense to what had happened, he could not help falling back on Ferrante. Ferrante, following him closely, had sold to the enemy the secrets he knew, and then shamelessly had joined the adversary's ranks to enjoy the well-earned reward. To make sure his father's death was not in vain, Roberto owed to him the conduct that all at Casale expected of the hero's son. He could not do otherwise. He found himself now the legitimate lord of La Griva, heir to the family name and possessions, and Toirat no longer dared employ him for little tasks, nor could he call on him for big ones. And so, left alone to sustain his new role of illustrious orphan, Roberto found himself still more alone, lacking even the comfort of action. At the heart of a siege, released from all duties, he asked himself how he should spend his days as a besieged soldier. Roberto asked himself, "During those days of siege, did I ever have any other hint of Ferrante? No. What happened then? I was convinced of his non-existence by Saint-Savin." Roberto had in fact made friends with Monsieur de Saint-Savin. When not prey to wine, Saint-Savin was an accomplished gentleman. Small of stature, nervous, brisk, and though his face was perhaps marked by the Parisian dissipation of which he spoke, he could not have been 30. He He inquired about Monsieur Pozzo, and Roberto was grateful to him for at least feigning interest. Roberto told how his father had taught him what he knew of fencing. Saint-Savin asked various questions, waxed enthusiastic. "You honor your father better now," Saint-Savin said, "by remembering his teachings than you did before, listening to that execrable Latin in church." "Monsieur de Saint-Savin, are you not afraid of ending up at the stake?" Saint-Savin frowned for a moment. "When I was more or less your age, I admired a man who had been an older brother to me, a philosopher, and moreover a priest. He ended up at the stake, but first they tore out his tongue and strangled him. And so you see that if we philosophers are quick of tongue, it is to dispel prejudice and to discover the natural cause of creation." "So you truly do not believe in God?"
"I find no reason to, in nature."
"If the idea of God is unknown in the state of nature, it must then be a human invention. But do not look at me as if I lacked sound principles and were not